Hi, I'm John Zogby, and welcome to another edition of the Zogby Report, real and unscripted. Those of you who have been watching and listening already know the score. I, John, along with my son Jeremy, discuss an issue or two of recent days, often from different points of view, sometimes not, but it's always civil and respectful, and I hope that we can be a role model for others, notably in Washington. I didn't open up with it's another Friday, simply because it's not Friday. This is a special circumstance, so we're actually taping this on Wednesday. It won't be shown or available until Friday, so in case there is breaking news later today or through Thursday and overnight, and we've missed it, there's a very good reason why we can't predict the future. Although, Jer, we do try our best to do that, don't we, sometimes?
We do, with a little bit of clairvoyance.
Yes. Okay, so Jer is waiting for the topic, and I think this one is unavoidable. There were hearings that began on Tuesday in Congress, special select committee appointed by the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, to look into what happened and how it happened and who was responsible for the events of what we now call 1-6, January 6th. We all know that what took place essentially was that after former Mayor Rudy Giuliani and then immediately former president, he wasn't former president, he was still president on January 6th, Donald Trump spoke to a very large rally that did not accept the results of the election, that hundreds, well over a thousand, even thousands, marched over to the Capitol and stormed the Capitol and took over the Capitol for a while. It was more than a protest. It was violent. They not only broke through windows and barriers, but some people were severely hurt. And in fact, a DC police officer was killed. A woman protester was killed. It was a frightening moment. Here's what I don't understand. How did this become a political issue? Or why did it become a political issue? Anybody who watched that day saw exactly what happened. It was the moment that Congress constitutionally is supposed to certify the results of the election. And really, there was no doubt whatsoever, including by respectable Republicans, of what had happened. Joe Biden won the popular vote by more than 6 million votes, and the electoral vote, though close, in some states, had been close before. There hasn't been really any evidence, or at least sufficient evidence, to say that Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or even razor-thin Georgia and Alabama were stolen in any way. But let's say they were. Let's say that the tables were turned as they were in 2000, even 2004. When Democrats could have been equally angry, but you didn't see Democrats storming the Capitol when Al Gore lost or when John Kerry conceded. Why is this political? What's going on here?
I think it's no surprise. I mean, if somebody is to read, and remember, historical analogies are never perfect. I think Mark Twain put it best, history does not repeat itself, it rhymes, right? So in other words, you definitely look to the past to an analogous event, but don't expect the exact thing to play out, but mm-hmm. you can see a similar framework, a skeleton, a blueprint. And so I'm talking about, of course, the Civil War. And there's a, you know, I took a class on dedicated to the Civil War, and I read probably the greatest work ever written on the Civil War, and that's The Battle Cry of Freedom by James McPherson. 1,000-page book that covers the leading up to it. And of course, this was years ago that I read it, but what I heard you discussing reminded me of the lead up, especially the decade before the Big Bang, the decade of the 1850s, especially the late 1850s, where there was such mistrust towards both sides, towards both the North and the South, towards the different cultures, the parties that were at odds with each other. And here we are. And you know, if you then take a look at another historical work, The Fourth Turning was at Strauss and Howe, right?
Strauss and Howe, yeah.
Every 70 years, America goes through tumultuous events. So 1790, or the establishment of the Constitution, was a pretty tumultuous time. 70 years later is 1860, the Civil War. 70 years later, about 70 years later after that, of course, is the Great Crash of 29, and basically leading up to World War II, and ending with 45, an establishment of a new order, you could say, a new regime. And what we see now is the breakdown of that regime. It's 70 years later, it's on time. And you could say that there's a decay, there's a rot, there's a rage, there's a mistrust towards both sides. If you want to pin the blame on Donald Trump, you can do that. I think that's incredibly short-sighted. I think if Trump didn't rise to the occasion, somebody else similar would have. Whoever the candidate would have been in 2016, it would have been ugly, maybe not as ugly, but it was on course. And I guess you could say maybe it was kind of baked into the cake. So that's the situation that we are at, is that there's so much distrust towards the leadership, towards each other. And then, of course, the public doesn't trust the leadership. It's a very complicated issue.
All right. So I have a number of questions, and I think that that's a very smart analysis that you just gave. So should we be thankful that this kind of tumult doesn't occur more, that in fact we can almost expect it, and that we're very fortunate that in between that there are many periods of let's say peace and prosperity and even progress? Should we be thankful then that it doesn't occur more?
I guess that's, I suppose that's a way of putting it, right? But no, I think it's unavoidable, because I think the leadership is so out of touch with reality. And then, of course, you also just, I talked about that, you know, that cycle of about 70 years. It's the life of a regime. It's the second law of thermonuclear dynamics, put into the context of a political regime. By the third generation, you have power players that are still in power. I mean, here's just one off the top, man. You still have somebody like Henry Kissinger, who is a very influential person. You have people who have been powerful bureaucrats for 40, 50 years, Dr. Anthony Fauci, Joe Biden, Pelosi. It's not just that, obviously, others on the Republican side as well. They are out of touch with reality, and they know how to hold on to power, and they know how to keep their positions. But meanwhile, there's all these dynamics happening on the ground, and they're missing the point, and they're further driving a wedge in society. And we should only expect that there's going to be more tumult, more tumultuous things like what we saw on January 6th. That's how I would
describe. Okay, and so this leads then to the second question, which is, after each of those tumultuous periods, something new and different and huge and even great emerged. Okay, so after the Civil War, we have a period of massive and rapid industrialization, right? And urbanization and global markets, a technological boom, greater prosperity for the working class, although if you were working class, it may not have felt that way, but it was certainly better than toiling as a peasant on farms, urbanization and so on. After the New Deal, the Great Depression and World War II, you had a tremendous growth in government in the sense that you had the expansion of the welfare state that had actually begun around the turn of the century, but a massive expansion of the welfare state, but at the same time, steady growth of the defense budget and a period of prosperity based on both an expansion of government largesse and the military. What happens after this one? We are clairvoyant, remember.
Well, I'll take a stab at it, and then yeah. You as well. Okay, I wouldn't say that the pillars of prosperity rested on government largesse. That was the effect, right? That's what we experienced. But what got government largesse to that level? What got the United States to the status of the behemoth on the world stage was the Bretton Woods system, the Bretton Woods Agreement. You go around the world and you hear the dollar is king. Well, that the Bretton Woods system propped up the American dollar to be the most powerful currency. Every nation in the world, if they were going to trade, were going to trade in dollars, and dollars were as good as gold. And so obviously the Bretton Woods system fell apart, but Kissinger came up with what is known as the petrodollar, and that saved the preeminence, the dominance of the dollar. So I think a lot of this is monetarily and economically driven in terms of the life of those political regimes. So we are at a cusp right now or a crossroads after the COVID-19 crisis. And now there's talk of a centrally digitalized central bank digital currency that other countries are talking. China's actually very close to setting one up. And so I don't know, maybe in the Wall Street Journal you read about it, it's called the Fed coin. But it would eradicate cash if it is to go forward. And it would be a purely digital payment system. On the privacy side of things, there's no more anonymity. Everything that you do is tracked. And so, I mean, it could go that route. It could go maybe more towards something like a world currency. Of course, the magazine The Economist has talked about SDRs, special drawing rights, and those are typically used by the IMF in emergencies. But most recently, SDRs, which are a basket of the major currencies, have included the yuan. And so, does that signal something like some kind of basket of currencies that serve as a world currency? That could be a possibility. Or maybe there's a breakdown of all kinds of national currencies because of the major debt issues across the world economies. We are at an amazing moment, and it's very difficult to see which way it goes, but it seems to be those are about the three options. What about you? What do you think?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer is I don't know. It can go in both directions. It can go in one direction and then flip and go in the opposite direction. But it looks to me, just going back to an earlier point that you had made, that, you know, Bretton Woods and the United Nations and that post-war world were based on an American model. Everyone else had fallen apart. We were the superpower along with the Soviet Union, but we always had much more stability than the Soviet Union, and a lot of that had to do with democratic institutions. We're probably coming to a point, you know, Fareed Zakaria has talked about the rise of the rest. George Friedman, the futurist, also talks about a multipolar world where, you know, you have Turkey, you have Poland, in fact, you have Brazil in South America, Nigeria and South Africa, where you don't have one dominant superpower, obviously China and India. But it looks to me as if at some point, and given where millennials and Gen Z are at with less loyalty to a nation state or even a permanent home, that we're probably talking about a non-polar world eventually, a genuine decline in nationalism, and then a replacement with global lawmaking, global regulations, global institutions of enforcement, global institutions of cooperation. As a reminder, in early October, we're going to have a guest, Parag Khanna, on, who underscores that point in a number of his writings, and will be talking about his new book called Move, about the movement, the free movement of younger people all over the world, and those very points that I just made. But I'll be interested to see what the book says. It hasn't come out yet. And what he thinks about what we're talking about. But that's not in 2023 or in 2024. This is a slow and steady breakdown of what we have, because what we have is clearly not sustainable. But let's go back to the immediate. Was this tantamount on January 6th to storming the Bastille, to the Boston Tea Party, to the act of violence, maybe the Bloody Kansas in 1854, or the Brooks-Sumner incident where Congressman Brooks beat Senator Seward of Massachusetts over the head with a cane, knocked him unconscious for a long time. Is this where we're at today?
It could very well be, although, you know, I don't like to pin the side on one blame. I always enjoy pinning the blame on both sides. And so, I mean, and I've said this many times, it goes back to 2016. It goes back to the denial of the presidency of Donald Trump. And you and I were saying when we started this, the video version of this podcast, we were saying in September and October that whoever wins, the other side is simply not going to accept it. And so if we imagine that Trump had won, we would have likely seen almost the exact same situation, maybe not on January 6th, maybe on another day, maybe on Christmas, maybe on, you know, before that, December 17th, who knows? But
you know what, Jerry? I agree with you on that, at least insofar as if you had an identical scenario where Trump won the popular vote and he'd been on top in the Electoral College and there were close states, I'm not sure that the Democrats would have accepted it.
No, they wouldn't have, because they didn't accept it in 2016, and they carried that with them for 4 years. And so what they would have said was, understanding, being objective and walking a day in their moccasins, they would have said two times, this happened to us two times, there would have been rage. There, no question about it. This is just the dysfunctional nature of a two-party system, of a duopoly, that you know, in the imperial city lives the high life, but the rest of the country, or not, you know, the entire rest of the country, but a lot of the country lives in a totally different reality. And so that's what's at stake. But back to your point, is this the Bastille? Is this the Boston Tea Party? Let's put it this way. It doesn't have to be, but antagonizing And continuing the war of language will ensure that it happens. And I feel very much like that's likely within the next 4 years. So what has to happen, because we don't want to just talk about problems, we want to talk about solutions, is we have to hold the leaders and the journalists and the media and the reporters all accountable. The culture needs to switch from labeling to listening. Imagine in America where listening takes priority over labels. There is no shortage of labels, and mm-hmm. they're becoming more and more inflammatory. And while that's is a good short-term strategy and scoring points and putting points on the board and winning the game, it is a terrible long-term strategy.
So Congress's job is to investigate and to legislate. And in this context, both the investigation and the legislation are to ensure that this kind of violence not take place again. Would you deny the legitimacy of these hearings? Do you think the Republicans should serve on the committee? Do you think the Republicans in good faith should have put 5 members on the select committee who at least wanted to get at the truth of what happened and why it happened? Or do you understand how Kevin McCarthy and the Republicans have played this, appointing Jim Jordan and Congressman Bent to, who voted to decertify or at least to not certify the results of the election, and Pelosi's response to that? Well, I mean, what do you think? Is this a legitimate investigation that's taking place, rhetoric notwithstanding?
I honestly don't know. I honestly can't answer that. What is most worrisome is look, we have a surveillance state. There's no secret about that. We've had a surveillance state since J. Edgar Hoover, but we've had a gargantuan surveillance state since George W. Bush. And with each presidency, it's grown. And it's Joe Biden has already made it clear that it's going to go to the next level. What I'm terribly concerned about is the next level of political weaponization in terms of going after the opponents. And I don't know how far that or how wide that net will be casted. I don't know if they're just going to keep it to, well, let's just keep it to extremist groups, and hopefully they do that for both left and right extremist groups, or whether they're kind of, casting that net wider. That's what's really front and center here.
So we've got hackers worldwide that have already done serious damage, and we know they have the capacity to do even worse damage in the form of cyber attacks that shut down businesses, shut down dams, shut down grids, make it impossible for business to be conducted. So we already know of that. We also know that white supremacist groups, terrorist groups, are all over some form of the web, are highly networked and highly sophisticated in their capacity to communicate and to plan with each other. Doesn't law enforcement have to stay on top of it by staying on top of the technology, mastering the technology, and fighting each new weapon with similar weapons? Or is this a cycle that needs to be broken? And do we lose if we do it?
I mean, if you put it that way, then yes, it has to be done, right? We have to root out every single...
That's the kind of answer I was looking for, incidentally. No, but go ahead.
No, I mean, it's a loaded question.
Right? So how would you phrase it?
The challenging question of the day, of the week, if not the month. Okay, well, first off, you acknowledge that it's not just extremist groups on the right, that it's extremist groups on the left. You don't just say, look, white supremacy is the only problem. Antifa is a major problem too. I mean, we had an entire summer of riots where cities went up in flames. I mean, it wasn't just like a dozen cities, it was dozens of cities, and that was highly problematic. And that can happen again too. I think unfortunately, there is an element of antagonizing from the intelligence community. I think that there, you saw this with the new left, right? I mean, you were part
absolutely.
Of, yeah.
I taught right? labor and radical history. You know, the agent provocateur, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
that's like part of it is I think is addressing that and not just saying, well, you know, that was kind of a thing that the FBI were doing because they thought, you know, in the 60s that the anti-war people were a bunch of communists. No, they undermined a legitimate movement that actually had the moral high ground. And they, you know, we know what they did.
And there was COINTELPRO as well. I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. It's a conversation. And so, I mean, we know that happened then. As I've mentioned before, two of the groups that got most of the blame from January 6th, the Proud Boys, and help me out. What's the other group?
The something keepers.
Oath Keepers. Yes. Thank
Oath
you.
Keepers.
Yes. In both cases, the head people in that, one was an FBI asset back in 2014, and another one, I forget his name, but the CBS News covered this. I was thankful for that. He's had security clearance, a high level security clearance since the late 70s. So what's going on there? I mean, maybe there needs to be more investigation into that, right? So. I mean, I wonder how much of this is organic and homegrown, and I wonder how much of it is astroturf. We know from history that empires want to grow. They want to expand their power. They never voluntarily cut their power and their resources. And unfortunately, it's one of those questions of who benefits. So, I mean... Is it the question that needs to be investigated is it exaggerated or is it really going to topple this country?
So let's end on this note with this question that we'll both answer. Is this congressional investigation legitimate? I say yes, but I agree with you that it needs to be expanded.
I think it needs
legitimate. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it needs to be both bipartisan, so once they have both parties involved, and it needs to be nonpartisan in its language, but I don't think that's going to happen.
That's not going to happen. Okay, we'll end on a happier note next week, maybe. But this was great. You're a very smart guy. Thank you.
Well, you asked challenging questions, so you kind of forced me to think a lot faster than I normally would.
I'll see you. Take care. Goodbye, everybody. And please spread the word about the podcast. Take care.